yields this low, and it really was a very index-led rally today. At some point this afternoon, I pointed out the NASDAQ, the S&P, and the Dow were all up precisely 0.61%. That does not come from investors deciding exactly which stock to buy and which one to sell and whose fundamentals are better. It's a rush to get equity exposure in the biggest, most liquid way.
A big November rally in bond yields could spark the next leg higher. Money has continued to flow into bond funds.
The Commerce Department reporting U.S. retail sales rebounding in October.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Dow Industrials top 28,000 for the first time ever. U.S. retail sales rebounded in October, and the New York Fed adds $68 billion to financial markets in the form of a repurchase agreement operation. My name is Chris Prytower, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. On the News Hour today, we have Ralph McLaughlin from CoreLogic. He believes this is an important demographic moment in that young people are starting to buy homes. He believes it's going to support the housing market over the next 20 years. And we have technician Art Hill from TrendInvestorPro.com. He says the rally is broad-based and explains why the market is so healthy. But he also shares why he's on the fence with the breakout in the Russell 2000. Of course, Ryan Poplava will tell us what moved the markets this week. And then on the big picture, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava discuss signs of an upturn in global growth, fund flows, and how Financial Sense Wealth Management is positioning client accounts based on these recent developments. All of that and more coming up on this edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining us in the studio today is Ryan Poplava. Ryan, Dow Jones Industrial Average topped 28,000 for the first time on Friday. What led to the advance in stocks this week?
Well, Chris, the big move came mainly on Friday with, like you said, just a real big push past 3,100 for the S&P 500, and then, like you said, 28,000 for the Dow. And it was really based on the NEC director Larry Kudlow's claim that the Phase 1 trade agreement is almost here. Have you heard that before? We acknowledge that it isn't quite ready. Oh, what do you know? But investors really focused on the word close, as good news since earlier in the week was a speech by President Trump that a deal is close. There it is, that word again. But it has to be good for America. And if no deal, then there was the familiar threat that, you know, that equals the tariff hammer would hit the Chinese with more fees. If that happens, I think we'd all see, obviously, a sea of red. And interestingly, when he made those comments, that really the equities, the investors really shrugged it off and any concern that there's still quite a bit of hope. But, you know, the regurgitation of we're close seemed to really reinvigorate the risk-on trade on Friday and set us to new highs, thanks to Kudlow. It's still up in the air, folks, though. You know, next week, there's not a deal until there's a deal.
Well, trade continues to be at the heart of equity performance. But like you said last week, Ryan, stocks are also supported by an accommodative Fed that investors are in complete sync and agreement with. And the addition of some positive developments in economics that clearly have fueled stock advances to new composite highs.
Well, especially for large cap, you know, which would likely benefit with a pickup in global growth.
Ryan, what other news can you tell us, though, about the market this week other than trade? And what I wanted to ask, I mean, any key economic news like sector news or company catalysts?
Well, Trump dropped a major news item with the transparency rule in hospital pricing on Friday afternoon. We immediately saw a huge uptick in managed healthcare, in pharmaceuticals and biotech. And basically, it requires hospitals to publish or disclose the rates that they negotiate with insurance companies for services, drugs, supplies, and you name it. So that was huge. In fact, that was the best performing sector on Friday when the market really took off to new highs. One piece of information that was of great interest to me, maybe not necessarily the market, was that report that South Korea's exports were down 20% year over year, while imports were down 21% year over year. And that was for the first couple of weeks of November, so kind of getting some idea right now. Still hasn't quite turned around for Korea. And Korea is very important. I'll explain in a little bit if you want. But exports of semiconductors in particular for Korea were down 33% year over year.
And Ryan, you guys are invested in semiconductors. If I'm not mistaken, you're invested as a satellite investment to your diversified core. Am I correct?
Yeah. We're invested in semis for our growth and growth of income portfolios, which have a bigger allocation to equity so we can be a little more, we can expand a little more on the areas. And we've been considering investing in some money in Korea as it's typically a leading indicator on global growth. There's this talk about, is the global growth turning around? So I know that I think Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be talking about that in greater depth in the big picture later on. But like I said, on the investment team, this is one area that we're focusing on quite a bit. And since their exports are around 44% of GDP, that's really high. And so if they're going to turn around and we're seeing their GDP doing well, they're exporting, that's a sign that we've got a healthy global economy on our hands. So we're definitely watching it very closely. And if it responds well, these to a global recovery, we'll be seeing that in the stock prices there in Korea. We have another indicator we follow very closely called the Semiconductor Industry Association's Global Semiconductor Sales Index. All right. It's just another index on semiconductors. It's showing a tick up in the year-over-year rate of change in sales. So that's something that we're honing in on. And even though Korea exports continue to drop, we think a turn may be in the cards for them and the world in general. As I said, Chris will probably want to really dig in there as we've had 2 years of deceleration and or contraction. But the big catalyst for semiconductors was Applied Materials results on Friday. So let's take a look at that. They provided the equipment and materials to make semiconductors, so their results are a bellwether on the industry. And they beat expectations and guided higher. That's the key point right there. They guided higher on the next quarter. NVIDIA also posted positive results, but conservative guidance that has reverberated well with other companies in the space, not necessarily doing so well with NVIDIA, but did explain why these stocks done so well and justified its growth. And I think it's been up like 30 or 40% in the past few months. Now, these results helped drive the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index to new all-time highs at the end of this week. And so that's definitely helping us. Now, Walmart impressed with its quarter and guidance on Thursday, but Cisco disappointed with its forward guidance, and that hurt the stock there. Rockwell Automation, another key player in the industrial sector, had an upbeat report, and I believe the talking about continued performance, that's really helping the sector. Typically, cyclical leadership in the stock market, which is what we're seeing, is looked at as a very positive situation for the expansion of the economic cycle. Unfortunately, industrial production was released on Friday, showing yet another drop, declining 0.8% in October. But here's the silver lining. United Auto Worker strike contributed to that in October and has since been resolved. So we're looking at November as hopefully being a better month in industrial production.
As we approach the holidays here, Ryan, I mean, obviously just fantastic news, headline financial news going on right now. But as we do look ahead, anything to keep an eye on in the news next week?
Well, next week, we'll be paying attention to some of the November leading economic indicators. So that's your Philadelphia surveys and things like that we start to get mid-month. So again, to figure out, we looked at the ISM number tick up. Are we seeing a continuation of that in November? We really want to watch closely on that. I think the market will be as well. Then there's next week, we should also get some big housing data. So that'll be important to follow and to see what that does to real estate sector.
Well, again, it's exciting to see the market go to 28,000 for the first time. It'll be interesting to see next week whether we have hit yet another record. Either way, Ryan, it's a pleasure to always have you in the studio. We look forward to next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Well, I'm actually looking for topping action in the market quite imminently. The manner in which we decline is going to tell me a lot about how we progress over the coming 3 to 6 months. I still think we're probably going to be dropping, coming back up, testing the highs again. I think we're going to be into this pattern for the next maybe 3 to 4 months. But what I'm seeing that's still quite troubling to me is there are a lot of structures on the underlying stocks, as well as in the market itself, that could still be pointing us back down into the 2100 to 2200 region for 2020.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
It's almost becoming repetitive. Week after week, the markets hit to new records. Despite all the conflicts out there, impeachment and also trade talks, well, the market seems to like what it's seeing. Join us on the program is Art Hill. Art, let's begin with the S&P. As I look at your market analysis page, I'm seeing breakouts. You've got the S&P at records. You've got the Dow at records. You've got small caps rising, mid caps rising. You've got the international markets rising. It seems like it's a breakout all across the globe.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me on. It is definitely a broad-based rally because we saw the EFA, which is Eurasia, Europe, Australia ETF, breaking out to new highs. So that's everything outside the U.S. And then, as you mentioned, the S&P 500 is breaking out to new highs. And it's overall a healthy market. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit short-term extended because, you know, we're up 7+% from early October to early November. So we might get a little rest. But, you know, we did consolidate from, say, the latter part of July until the middle part of October, and then started breaking out in the latter part of October. So we had a rest, we had a breakout. And, you know, a classic rule in technical analysis is, it's not a steadfast rule, of course, but, you know, we had resistance, say, in the 3,000-3,020 area for the S&P, and we might come back to that level and test it on a short-term pullback. So that's the first place I'd look for support.
You know, Art, one thing that was characteristic of this market pretty much the year was, I call it the risk-off trade. You saw within the S&P sectors, you saw utilities, consumer staples, REITs lead. You saw gold going up. You saw TLT, the Treasury ETF, leading. Those were doing very, very well up until recently. Now you've seen gold pull back, TLT pull back. Utilities are in a downswing along with REITs. So is this looking more like a risk-on trade to you?
We've definitely seen a shift, but it hasn't been that risk-off all year. Because if you do a, say, a year-to-date comparison now, and what I did was I did a comparison looking at, say, the first 9 months, and utilities was the second best performing sector. Staples was the third best performing sector, but technology was still the first best, the top performing sector for the first 9 months. And then if you go out the last month or so, going out about, say, 30 days, then you can see where utilities are actually down. So they have really suffered as money has, not a lot of money moving out of utilities because they only account for like 3% or less of the S&P 500. But the biggest thing is we've seen this resilience in financials and industrials. And those are two offensive sectors that were kind of just plodding along in 2019. The first, that big surge, of course, off the December low. But, you know, from, say, March until September, they were kind of just plodding along. And then they just took off in October. And when you have financials and industrials hitting new highs, that tells me that the market is, the strength is broadening, and that's a good thing.
I want to talk about bonds for a second here because, you know, we started out the year with 10-year Treasury yields at 3.25%. And of course, leading into last year, the Fed was very hawkish when it came to the end of the third and fourth quarter. And it's hard to believe, Art, that, you know, in September, we were looking at yields on 10-year Treasuries at 1.4%. And here we are backing up almost to 2%, having come down from 3.25% down to 1.4%. I mean, so I don't know if listeners really understand how dramatic that is in yields when you go from 3.25% to 1.4%. Now we're back up to almost 1.2% again.
Yeah, that was an unbelievable move from that October 2018 high to early September low, cutting in half, as you said, going down to 1.4%. So there's been that big bounce up back towards, you know, the 1.92% area. But if I look at it on a chart, you know, it became way overextended to the downside because it was a really sharp move down from April to the end of August. And so it looks like, you know, we just gotten a bounce. It's been a big bounce, but it's still within a bigger downtrend. The 10-year is still below the falling 200-day moving average.
So, Art, when you're looking at this, what really surprises me, I read two articles recently in the Wall Street Journal. One, pension funds are really starting to pour into the market because a lot of these pension funds are assuming a return of over 7% to hit their retirement goals for their retirees. And then also the record amounts of cash on the sideline. So if pension funds are moving into the market, they're increasing their allocation to stocks. And at the same time, individual investors have been pulling out, going into bonds or into cash. It seems to me, sentiment-wise or contrary thinking, there's a lot of fuel on the sidelines that could make this market go higher.
Yeah, I think this rally really has climbed what they would call the proverbial wall of worry. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, we've had the tariff issues. Earlier, we had the inverted yield curve. You know, there's so many things out there. But if you just look at the price of the S&P 500, it's just been chugging along basically since April. You had the big surge up January, February, March, and then it started zigzagging higher, and it's still an uptrend. Now, as far as how high it can go, I don't like to put upside targets, but I would think, you know, with this year end coming in, and if people haven't put money to work, they're going to be looking to put it to work before year end. So I think that could juice the market even further, especially since we have a fairly fresh breakout.
Yeah, I want to talk about gold here. It has really taken off since we take a look at last summer, and it got up over 1,500. It looked like it was breaking out, broke out above 1,400. What's your take on gold here? Because it's been rather weak, at least over the last couple of months.
So gold is, you know, it's kind of a mirror image of the 10-year Treasury yield. You know, you look at that rally we've had from, say, October of last year all the way up to the end of August, and that's when the 10-year was falling. And so the 10-year gets a little bounce, and gold falls. And, you know, it still looks like a corrective move when I look at gold. It's above the rising 200-day moving average. You had this really sharp advance from around 1280 to 1560 in about 3 months, and that was overextended. And you needed to digest those moves. You can't just keep moving at that pace and expect it to be sustainable. And so now gold has come back, and it's just above kind of a consolidation from July. So it might be finding some support here and could be forming a corrective pattern. So I'd keep my eye on it. But the problem, I think, or the challenge with gold is when you have stocks breaking out and what looks like a broadening bull market in stocks, and then you see what happened to stocks in October and gold is underperforming, it seems like there are better alternatives out there than gold right now.
You also were getting into seasonality-wise, and I'd like to get your thoughts here. Typically, with the exception of last year, normally when you get around the end of October all the way to the end of the year, they call it the Santa Claus rally. You have a very strong finish. Now, of course, that didn't happen last year, but the Fed was raising interest rates aggressively, making very, very hawkish statements, and that had an impact on all asset classes, including bonds and commodities. But given that the Fed has gone in the opposite direction, it's adding liquidity, pouring that into the market, and we've got all this cash on the sidelines, why not, if history repeats itself, could we not see another strong finish as we do most of the time around this time of the year?
Oh, we definitely could see a strong finish. And if you look at a seasonality chart, you also see that, you know, November, of course, is also a very strong month, and we haven't even finished November yet. And December does tend to rise, I think, over the last 30 years. December closes higher over 70% of the time. So there's clearly a bullish bias built in to the end of the year with November. Of course, it also is part of the six-month cycle as well coming into play. You know, November, December, January, February, March, and April. And that's when the six-month cycle ends. So I would not be surprised at all to see further strength into year end. And that would be a lot different from what we saw last year when we had that meltdown just before Christmas.
I wonder if you might just speak about the significance of the breakout that we're seeing in other sectors. Like we mentioned before, it was three safety sectors. It was consumer staples, utilities, REITs, and technology, as you pointed out. Everything else was lagging. Now, Art, you have the financials looking very strong, strong breakouts in financials, healthcare, industrials, and materials. So when you see the base broadening and the number of sectors participating, does that kind of confirm your idea about a broad-based rally and this could continue even further? In other words, we're firing on almost all cylinders now.
Yeah, and we're firing on the big cylinders as well. If you look at the sector weightings within the S&P 500, healthcare is still the second biggest sector at about 14%. And it's hit a new high for 2019. Hasn't quite hit a 52-week high, but it's very close, and I would expect it to do that. And if, you know, if you think it's not just a large cap affair, because I was also looking at the equal weight sectors. So the equal weight finance ETF RYF is at a 52-week high. So that tells you that the average stock in the finance sector is doing just fine. The equal weight consumer discretionary sector also hit a 52-week high here in early November. So it was kind of correcting, you know, from April, May, June, July into September, and it got this surge and breakout. So you got consumer discretionary finance. And then the last one is industrials. And the equal weight industrial sector actually hit a new high in September and then again in October. So we've got some really broad strength in some strong sectors outside of technology.
Let's talk about some of the other issues that are supporting this upsurge, and that is market breadth. Whether you're looking at put-to-call ratios, you're looking at advanced decline lines, some oscillators, they tend to be supportive as well.
Yeah, if you look at the AD lines, a lot of them did hit new highs. So that tells you that, you know, it is a broad-based advance. I look at the S&P 500 AD line, it hit a new high. The mid-cap AD line hit a new high, as did the small cap and the NASDAQ 100 AD line. So there is broad strength. We're still kind of on the fence when it comes to this breakout in the Russell 2000, because it is, you know, right at the, hasn't made a new high for 2019 yet. It hasn't broken above those resistance levels that extend back into May. But it's, you know, doing a little consolidation here in November, kind of looks like a little bull flag, and that could be the prelude to a breakout and a 52-week high in the Russell 2000.
Finally, I want to talk about commodities. One of the worst performing sectors has been for almost the last year and a half has been energy. It doesn't matter what happens, you know, they blow up a Saudi oil facility. You know, that popped oil for maybe 1 or 2 days, and then oil has been in a downtrend, kind of stuck between $50 and $55 a barrel. Let's talk about commodities. I don't care if you're looking at gold, if you're looking at copper. If this rally, as we're seeing globally, not just in the U.S., but around the globe, it would signify that, at least from the PMIs, they look like global PMIs are bottoming, central banks are loosening interest rates around the globe. Let's talk about commodities for a minute. What are the charts telling you there?
Well, oil is a bit interesting because, yeah, I see the Saudi spike there in September, and then we came right back down to that August low. But oil does show, you know, some support from the June, August, and October lows in the low 50s. And oil has been moving higher since the early part of October, along with the stock market. So there is some upward movement in oil. I don't know how far it can go, but I think, you know, the breakout in the global equity markets would support further upside in oil, at least, you know, limit downside. And some of the more beaten up sectors and groups have to do with oil. The sector energy, of course, remains below its September high. And the oil and gas equipment and services ETF is testing its 52-week lows. So they haven't participated yet.
Art, what would you tell investors listening that have been on the sidelines, mainly in cash? The Wall Street Journal article, as I mentioned, talked about records amount of cash being pulled out of the market, put into cash by individual investors, and comments like, well, I'm going to wait for a major correction before I get back in. What if that major correction doesn't take place?
Well, I would say there are some opportunities out there in the stock market because A, we're in a bull market. B, we have a pretty fresh breakout. C, we've seen the market advance broadening with small caps actually, you know, leading over the last 6 weeks as far as percentage gain. They're still lagging over a 9-month time frame. But overall, things do look bullish. And when you're bullish, you have to expect, I think, bullish resolutions. And two groups that I am liking, one is the FinTech ETF, FINX. It corrected down to its rising 200-day from August to October, and now it's turning back up, and it looks like its correction is ending, and it's ready to resume that uptrend. And the other one is the software ETF, IGV, Microsoft. Hitting new 52-week highs, a very strong stock. And that one, too, is above its 200-day IGV is. And it looks like it's ending its corrective period and resuming its bigger uptrend.
You know, it's absolutely amazing when you look at some of these companies, whether it's Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, Google. I never thought I'd ever see the day in my career, Art, that you would have companies that would be worth over $1 trillion or more than the GDP of major countries.
It's crazy. I know it. They just keep getting bigger. But, you know, Google, very strong stock hitting a 52-week high. Microsoft hitting a 52-week high. Disney had that big pop after they announced and released or set to set their new channel into streaming channel into business. The big laggard is Amazon. It's still stuck near these spring and early fall lows. It's near support. It's just below its 200-day. So that might be one to watch to see if it will play a little bit of catch-up, see if we can get a breakout above the November high.
Well, Art, listen, as we close, it seems like, as you mentioned, the markets are broadening out. Everything looks good, firing on all cylinders. Tell our listeners about stock charts. I especially love your market page where you basically take a look at all the major sectors around the globe, from commodities to currencies to bonds, the different indexes, the different sectors. And what I like that you guys have done, before you would have to look at these and then you'd have to click on it to get a chart. But now you just simply just click on the index and the chart appears right alongside of it.
Yeah, the summary page is really good because it does put that little chart on the left-hand side. And so you can get, you know, in one glance, you get a really good overview of the stock market. You start with the top and you look at the major indexes. You've got the DAX and the French index as well, so you can get a global outlook. Then you dive into the U.S. indexes, and I can see, you know, the transports hit a new high this month, and so did the Dow. So they both hit a new high for all Dow theory enthusiasts. And then you get the sectors. And then you get the industry groups, and then you go down to international further. You can also set it to ETFs as well if you just want to follow ETFs. And this is free. This is available to anybody. You just go to stockcharts.com/free charts, and you can access all the free tools there.
Yeah, I tell you, it's one of my go-to pages when I get up in the morning. I can go to one page and take a look and get a survey. It's kind of like looking at everything at 40,000 feet, and it's all right there on a single page. Well, Art, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. And once again, that website is stockcharts.com. Art, thanks for joining us on the program.
All right, Jim, thank you very much.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
And I think oftentimes when we're talking about the services sector, we're talking about what's going on with the U.S. consumer. Those things tend to be related. And similarly, when we're talking about manufacturing, we're talking about what's going on. There's a lot of overlap with that view of what's going on with business investments. So that's something to keep in mind. Yes, it's a small part of the economy, but it can have an outsized impact on economic growth.
Some of the good news about the Fed cutting interest rates is just not that it's helping the stock market, but it is also helping the real estate market. Refinancings are up, and the housing market seems to be strong. Joining us on the program is Ralph McLaughlin. He's Executive Deputy Chief Economist at CoreLogix. Ralph, I want to begin with the real estate market. We've seen a bit of a turn up here in the last couple months as mortgage rates have come down. What are you seeing as you look around the country in various regions? Is this across the country? In other words, is it nationwide, or is it contained to specific areas only?
Well, the trend primarily we are seeing is nationwide, and there are certainly idiosyncratic differences depending on the markets that you look at. But yes, absolutely. If you squint really, really hard at a time series map of home price growth in the U.S., you could see that September brought us the first positive uptick in home prices in almost a year and a half. So wow. Home price growth had been slowing. It's still been positive, but it had been slowing for 16 months. So every month was seeing lower appreciation rates than the previous month, cooling, for lack of a better word. August and September brought us the first month where there was actually an increase over the previous month since early 2018. And we at least think a decent part of that reversal is due to mortgage rates, like you mentioned, that have fallen drastically since about a year ago when they peaked at near 5%. So that's certainly helping increase refinancings, like you mentioned. But now we think it's trickling into the purchase market, and that makes sense because if you're a homeowner and you refinance, probably 95% of that decision is based on what mortgage rates are doing. But if you're buying a house, people buy houses for all sorts of different reasons, right? Because they get married, because they have children, and maybe a little bit because of mortgage rate. Now, to directly answer your question, are we seeing any differential trends across the U.S.? The answer is yes. We are starting to see the turnaround happen in some markets that were actually cooling significantly. So in places like Seattle and San Francisco, your neck of the woods, San Diego, and Los Angeles and Southern California, those areas not only were cooling like the rest of the country, but they were actually driving a lot of the national level cooling. In fact, home prices in Seattle fell for 3 or 4 months straight. San Francisco recently saw home prices fall. San Diego and LA were pretty close to zero for a few months. Now most of those markets are actually seeing price increases. San Diego ticked up pretty significantly. So we think those markets, especially very costly markets, of course, where interest rates do matter, it is starting to drive the markets up a bit. But they're still far below where they were, a year or two ago. This ties into a broader trend that we're seeing that we're sort of labeling a home price geographic demographic home price inversion across the U.S. And that is namely that if you look at which places are growing strongly and which places are sort of lagging, this time about a year ago, even before that, many of those markets that were leading the country are now at the bottom. They're now lagging. So places like Seattle and San Francisco and LA, those are now making up markets on the bottom of the list, when last year they were making up markets at the top. This markets at the top this year were either mid-pack or even towards the bottom last year. So places like Phoenix and Minneapolis and Charleston, those are all markets that had been bringing up the rear, you know, as recently as a year to 2 years ago. And now those places are leading the country. But a lot of that's due from the pullback from the big expensive markets, rather than any major boom happening in those other markets. But certainly, to characterize what we've seen over the last 6 months, it certainly has been an inflection point in the housing market. It seems to now be stabilizing.
Ralph, how much is this different by, let's say, home sector category? And I'm talking about, let's say, on like mansion versus, let's say, starter homes. I know here in California, one of the most expensive neighborhoods in San Diego has seen a drop of housing prices over 20%. Why other sectors of the market here are doing pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the upper end of the market certainly is struggling compared to the middle tier and the lower tier markets. You know, when home prices grow very, very strongly and they grow much faster than incomes, homes on the lower end of the price distribution don't necessarily go out of demand. In fact, if anything, demand for those homes increases because there are fewer people can afford the middle or upper tier home, but everyone can afford the lower tier home. And so they tend to move quickly. There tends to be less inventory around and prices tend to rise much faster on the lower end than the higher end. So just like some of the trends that we've seen in expensive markets versus cheaper markets, where expensive markets have slowed down, we see that across price tiers. We see much more pronounced slowing on the upper end of the market than we do on the lower end. So, you know, what you've seen in San Diego, both from a market level, but also a price tier level, is certainly mirroring what we've seen in many other markets and also trends at the national level.
You know, this is really surprising because you would think the upper end market would be booming because the stock market is booming. Another record year this year, double digit gains for the market. All the major indexes are in major high record levels. And you would suspect that people that have wealth are in the stock market, participating in that market, and that would be reflected in home buying.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, what I can say is that, yes, that the intuition is somewhat a counter, but when you actually look at what wealthy households spend their money on, it's not on housing. In fact, the proportion of wealthy households' income that's spent on housing, either to occupy or to invest in, is very, very small compared to the middle class and compared to the entry level home buyers. So, you know, what that really says to me is that wealthy home buyers, when they make, or wealthy homeowners, I should say, wealthy households, when they make money, they don't necessarily go out and buy housing. They're either a house to live in or to invest in. They put it in other investments. You know, I think the elasticity of demand on the high end when the stock market booms is pretty flat, to use, you know, an economist jargon, compared to, say, when household wealth increases for middle-income households. So really, when household wealth increases on the middle and lower end, that's when you see tangible changes in demand for housing, not necessarily on the high end.
Ralph, are you seeing any differences in high-tax states? I mean, the news has been filled recently in the last month with very high-profile billionaires, from Carl Icahn to the president, leaving New York, moving to Florida. There was a story here about California, the number of millionaires that have left the state, heading for places like Texas, Arizona, Nevada, and even Washington. Are you seeing that play out in housing prices and sales in those states as well?
Well, not really. And I can tell you why. That, you know, millionaires and billionaires make up a very, very small share of the housing market.
Okay.
Now, you know, except for, say, California, where there's a lot of millionaires. But, you know, because they make up such a small share of the market, you know, maybe some isolated areas, you would see noticeable impacts. I know you, I think you mentioned, was it Rancho Santa Fe in San Diego County? Yeah, they might be impacted, but I don't think they're really driving much of the market at all, primarily because there's so few of them. Now, certainly, you know, the high profile moves are interesting, and, you know, differential tax environments, you know, absolutely, you know, do get capitalized into home prices. But I don't think there's been any major changes in, the tax code over the last year, you know, at the state or federal level, for that matter, that really would be inducing this. So I think these are sort of isolated, high profile cases that make great stories to read about. But there's no major signs now that they're shaking up housing markets, with the exception of maybe some isolated areas, you know, like you mentioned in Rancho Santa Fe, in San Diego County, or other expensive locations.
You know what's interesting in this market and actually business cycle? We're what, in the 10th or 11th year of a cycle, Ralph? If you look at the stock market, it's at record levels. Is it cheap? No. Is it in a bubble? Many would argue it isn't. If you look at housing prices have been going up, but housing is not in a bubble. There's still strong demand. You compare this to what was going on, let's say, between 2006 and 2007. Why do you think we have not seen a bubble in housing? There's still strong demand. Builders have been circumspect, and there's still a strong demand out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think at face value, yes, where we're at in the cycle now looks very different than where we are in the previous cycle. And, I think some are certainly worried about the housing market being in a bubble. But I think the risk of a housing market bubble now is very, very low, despite being in a mature economic cycle. And that's really for two primary reasons. One, mortgage sector is not nearly as reckless as it was 12 or 13 years ago. So, the quality of loans that are being made look very, very good. And, there's not excessive lending. In fact, I think there is an argument to be made. Perhaps we could loosen up things a little bit. And I stress a little bit. We don't want to get too carried away. And two, and I think this is the real elephant in the room, is we are at a very important point in the demographic pyramid, which is basically an hourglass shape, where you have a lot of older people up top, you have few in the middle, and then you have a lot of younger people at the bottom. And the big portion at the bottom is just now getting to the age in their lives where they are wanting to buy homes. The oldest millennials now are 38 years old. Many of them are getting married and have kids and are buying houses. In fact, they make up a large share, the largest share of home buyers out there. And there's even more of them that are in their late 20s and early 30s. So this is a lot of demographic inertia that is starting to be released, and there's a lot more energy behind it. And regardless of where we're at in the economic cycle, that demographic inertia is going to support the housing market over the next 20 years, regardless of what happens, unless there's just a major world war or a major economic catastrophe. It's going to be very difficult for anything to rattle, you know, that fundamental, which is going to be a lot of new young households that are going to want to buy homes. And many of them are starting to do that. And I think that's the difference between where we're at now in this economic cycle compared to where we were at in 2005, 2006, 2007. 2005, 2006, 2007, you know, Gen X, which there isn't a lot of, were sort of tapping out their demand at a time when, you know, mortgage lending was high and there was a lot of supply on the market. And that's a recipe for catastrophe. Now we have record low supply, where we have a huge demographic structure that's going to support home buying going into the future. And, you know, we don't have a reckless lending environment.
So, Ralph, normally when you get towards the end of the business cycle, the Fed's raising rates. Now it's lowering rates. And if you take a look at the economy, some are saying, hey, we're due for a recession. But if you look at auto sales, they're not jumping, but they're still strong. Housing's strong. Retail sales are strong. The consumer's strong. Manufacturing's on the weak side. I just don't see signs of recession. Do you?
Yeah, we really don't. Certainly, as far as the clock is concerned, we're kind of due for one. But, we don't go into recession just because we haven't had one in a while, right? There's usually something that spurs a recession. And despite being, in a historically long economic cycle, there aren't many signs on the walls that we are headed for recession. I mean, yes, we are seeing volatility in the stock market. I think some of that is due to, geopolitical issues that are happening. But again, like for the same reason that I mentioned that demand for homes is going to be strong, both now and into the next two decades, that also is going to support demand for a lot of other goods, not just housing related goods, but, automobiles, both durable and non-durable goods. And so that's going to be a big boon for the market now. And, we really don't see a lot of signs the economy is in, is any trouble. And in fact, I think it's entirely possible that, the Fed perhaps was getting a little too aggressive with raising rates last year. And certainly with, quick pullback in the housing market that we saw in September, October, and in November last year suggests that, as well as, other slowing economic indicators. So, the fact that the Fed has pulled back and actually started to lower interest rates may suggest it was a good move. It was a beneficial move, either because the economy perhaps was teetering towards recession or the Fed got too aggressive last year. I can't tell you what the right answer to that is, but certainly pulling back on interest rates has helped keep this expansion alive.
So, Ralph, for those sitting on the side or thinking of jumping into the housing market for the first time, maybe it's a millennial couple that have gotten married, want to start a family, what would your advice be at this time?
Don't day trade your housing price. don't day trade your housing value. Don't look at the value of or the cost of a house. Now, certainly you want to buy one within your means, but the real benefits of buying a house, the real financial benefits of buying a house accrue over the long run. They accrue over 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years. So the important thing is that, depending on where you are in the country, if you can stay put for 5, 6, 7 years, it's going to be a better deal than renting. You may not get rich out of it. I know there's lots of stories of people in California or other markets that bought homes and then made six figures, but that's very atypical. The real benefits of a house, the most widespread benefits of a house, come from the benefits that accrue from not having to pay rent, and that takes a while because when you get a mortgage, the first 3, 4, 5 years, most of your payment's going to interest. So it takes a while to pay down your principal. And then, of course, there are fixed costs associated with buying a house. So my advice is don't worry about where we're at in the cycle. Think long and hard about whether or not you could stay put in your house for 5, 6, 7 years. If you can, it's going to be a better deal than renting. There's a possibility home prices might also rise, but if they don't, typically you'll still be okay. So, don't get caught up in treating your house like a stock and trying to day trade it or week trade it or month trade it. It's something that accrues over the long run, and make sure, you take that into account when whether you're trying to decide to buy a house or not.
Ralph, as we close, how can our listeners find out more about the work you guys do at CoreLogic? You really cover a thorough analysis of the housing market, whether it's rentals, apartments, single-family homes, or even delinquency rates.
CoreLogic.com/insights.
All right. Well, listen, Ralph, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best and have a great weekend.
You too. My pleasure joining you.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the show today is Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, when we had you on last month, you talked about how there was, you believed, an asymmetric outcome that was likely developing in the market, where the U.S. stock market had not hit new record highs at that point. We were still in that trading consolidation that we've been in for quite a while. Markets were looking a little toppy, but you said that investors appeared to be already positioned for the most bearish outcome, and therefore you saw limited downside risk, but actually more of an upside surprise in the markets. And lo and behold, over the past month, that's exactly what we've seen, with now all U.S. indices hitting new records. So since you got basically that call correct on how things were going to play out, why don't you give us an update on where things stand today?
The main thing that I was looking at about a month or so ago is, investors need to understand, is it's not just about fundamentals. Fundamentals obviously greatly matter, but there's other variables that you have to kind of take a look at to see how markets are responding. Because markets often at times will not respond in the way that you would think. A good example of that was last year. We were making the prediction that global growth had peaked and that U.S. growth would peak. And usually when growth peaks and starts to decelerate, equities have a hard time. But last year, we had the S&P continuing to rally to hit new highs and continue to perform well, while the average stock was not, global equities were not, the credit markets were taking a hit. And the reason for that, at least for U.S. large cap equities, was the massive amount of buybacks and the influence of the incremental demand that corporations were providing to the market, which were bidding up the large cap stocks much more so than smaller and medium sized companies. So there's other factors to play in beyond the fundamentals, and one of those is positioning. And what I was looking at was the amount of money that was flowing into money market funds and bond funds, you know, ETFs and mutual funds, relative to the amount of money that was flowing into equities. And so based on looking at those flows, it was clearly evident that investors were positioning themselves for the worst case outcome, which means that any positive inflection where news is less bad or better than what's expected, my thought was that the market could actually surprise on the upside, because that's not what people were positioned for. Essentially, the acronym FOMO, fear of missing out. And that's still, I believe, a potential that we could see, is more and more money that poured into money markets, that poured into fixed income, may come out and move into equities if we continue to see positive news developments in terms of economics data coming in, surprising to the upside. And what other investors also need to kind of learn is, the market responds not to necessarily levels, but rates of change. For example, when we have a positive surprise, you know, something could be still in negative territory, but just not as bad as what was expected. So if, you know, earnings are coming at -2 when everyone thought -4, the market's going to react favorably to that, even though earnings are still negative. So that's just an example of that. And that's essentially what I feel, is that economists became overly bearish and investors became overly bearish. So any positive incremental news would be a good reason for the market to rally.
And that's basically what we saw, right? We saw a number of good news announcements, of course, on the trade front, with more constructive news coming out about a phase one deal. I think on the day that you and I are speaking, it's November 14th. There's been a little bit of pushback on that for the past couple days. So obviously things are always in flux there, but we did see some positive economic news and geopolitically. So that's, I would assume, what led to that positive surprise that you mentioned on the show last time, with investors, like you said, taking that money that was on the sidelines in cash and then pushing that into equities with a fear of missing out. Bring us up to speed where we are today then, when you look at how investors are positioned. Are they now in the market, and are things looking a little dicey here? Has the investment attitude become a little too euphoric? What are your thoughts?
I've definitely seen money coming into the stock market when you look at ETFs and mutual fund flows. So there is some shift, and I believe that the turn has happened, but I still feel there's a lot more to go. I say that because I've been looking at data coming out from ICI and looking at the total amount of assets in money market funds and looking at the amount of assets and the growth of those assets over the last 12 months. money markets have grown in assets by north of 20% annualized from about a year ago. If you look at the amount of money flowing into fixed income, we've seen the annual growth rate of 28%. Now, let me put a little bit of context historically on that. When you look at the amount of money or the growth rate going into money market funds, this is the highest growth rate we've seen since the expansion began. If you remember in the last bear market, everyone was beginning to sell their stocks, sell their bonds, and go into money markets. So money market funds really exploded in the last downturn. And we had consistent selling in money markets as people re-engaged. But around 2014, even late 2013, we stopped seeing money coming into money market funds or coming out. So we had some, you know, kind of equilibrium. But the amount of money going into money market funds really began to pick up in 2018 and even exploded going into this year and by the middle of this year. So there was a huge jump in money market assets to the highest growth rate we had seen since the great financial crisis. Now, moving into fixed income, we have seen some pretty high growth rates in fixed income over the years during this cycle. 20% is very high. It's higher than what we saw over the last 5 years or so. The last time we were roughly about this high or a little bit more was in 2012, where we were growing, I think, north of 30 to 35% of assets moving into fixed income. So on the defensive side, you know, we have hit a fair extreme, you know, looking back the last 10 years, especially when looking at money market funds. Now, with equities, over the course of the last 10 years, there have been a few periods where the amount of money flowing into equities has essentially flatlined. That's what we saw in mid-2016 before the markets took off. And that's also what we saw in mid to late 2012 before the markets took off in 2013. So currently right now, the amount of flows going into equity funds, mutual funds, and ETFs is about 3% over last year. But one of the things that I look at is the difference in the rate of change between money going into bonds as well as stocks. And, you know, the difference in spreads roughly negative 24%, meaning that bonds have outpaced equity flows by that amount. And this is roughly where we saw the markets in 2016 by the middle of the year. And that was also when the markets had been undergoing a consolidation since late 2014. They really hadn't made much progress during that global slowdown. And mid-2016 is finally when the markets were able to break out and put on some gains and move out of that consolidation phase. And I think we may be entering that as well, kind of a repeat of maybe mid-2016. Now, I do believe the economic news will be coming in more favorably over the coming weeks and months, but I'm not expecting a very robust recovery. We had some pretty strong growth rates in 2016 and 17, and then we had the U.S. fiscal stimulus. So I do believe we'll have a recovery. I just feel it's going to be very tepid and weak. So I do want to put that out there.
Okay. And as you were discussing, when you look at the fund flows, when you break it down from bonds to money market or even into equities, in sum, what you're saying is that investors are basically positioned for a crash, or they're positioned quite defensively. Is that what the fund flows are telling you?
It does. This is the kind of behavior that we would see going into a potential recession or bear market, where investors kind of move out of risk assets, move into more defensive assets. And we've also seen a lot of money flowing into gold as well, which is oftentimes seen as a defensive asset.
Okay. And it sounds like you are taking a bit of a contrarian position compared to how investors are positioning when you look at those fund flows. And we'll have a chart of this if you want to take a look at it on Financial Sense so you can see the fund flows for yourself. But basically, as you discussed on our show last time, you said how at Financial Sense Wealth Management, you're moving from neutral to slightly overweight equities, and then also increasing exposure to international and cyclical investments given the current macroeconomic backdrop that you're looking at. So investors, when you look at the fund flows, are positioned for a crash, but it sounds like you're positioning more for a reacceleration.
That's correct. And the reason why I say that is when you look at the growth rates in terms of returns that you see in risk assets, they tend to be correlated with the growth cycle. So not necessarily the business cycle, but the growth cycle, meaning, you know, during a business cycle, you might have periods where growth is accelerating and then it decelerates but stays positive and never goes into negative territory, which is a recession. And so it's essentially the economy inhaling and exhaling. That's how I describe the growth cycle. And when growth accelerates, the equity returns accelerate. And when growth decelerates, equity returns typically are not as good. And so if we believe that the growth rate in the U.S. economy and global economy is beginning to stabilize and may begin an upturn, well, then we are also expecting that returns in the market are probably going to be improved compared to the last year and a half, where really most of the risk assets have gone absolutely nowhere. If you look at foreign equities, small cap stocks, mid cap stocks, you know, they've really, a lot of them are actually below their highs that they set in 2018.
Now, you're just showing me a chart of the OECD. That's the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. I believe it's 38 different countries, so it's a very large share of global growth. How their leading economic indicator appears to be ticking up, and this was something that we discussed on the show last time. It appears that things continue to be moving in that direction. Do you mind giving us an update on the global growth backdrop?
Absolutely. When looking at the OECD global indicator, so it's a pretty good overall, you know, 30,000 foot level, the global economy and how fast it's growing. In late 2017, early 2018, it was peaking at just under 4%, I believe, between 3 and 4%. And that was when we were noticing that peak and we were making the prediction that global growth would begin to fall. And looking at where it is today, it's just below 1%, about 0.83% compared to year-ago levels. We hit a lower level of growth than the last downturn, which was from 2014 to 16, but not quite as bad as we had in the 2010 to 2012 downturn. But it does look like we are starting to improve. The year-over-year growth rate is beginning to turn up. And there's other things that lead me to believe that may continue to move up. And a lot of that has to do with monetary policy. When looking at money supply growth in the big, you know, economic regions of the world, the U.S., China, and in Europe, looking at their money supply growth rates about, you know, 2 years ago, we were seeing them beginning to peak and roll over and slow down, which typically, you know, if you look at money supply, it's a great leading indicator for economic growth. The more money that goes into a system, the more it's going to turn over and the faster that growth will occur. And looking at some of the money supply growth rates in the U.S. and China, as well as Europe, they are starting to turn up. So that tells us we should begin to expect a turn up in leading economic indicators, which it does appear that they are starting to do in the process of.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, too, because I was just attending a presentation that Jim Bianco gave the other day, and he was talking about how global growth is really the driving force now outside of the U.S., I should say, emerging markets, China, they are in the driver's seat now. It used to be the U.S. and the developing world, but increasingly it's coming from those places, the developing countries, the low-income countries, as you referred to them. So when you are talking about the OECD, when you're talking about China, that's going to have a pretty important influence on the overall global business cycle when you're seeing their LEIs tick up, right?
That's correct. One of the old sayings on Wall Street, and especially from economists, is when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And that's where the U.S. essentially led the global economy on the upside and the downside, and everyone kind of tended to follow what we did with a lag. However, this last time, it was really the opposite. It was China slowing down and causing other countries to slow down. Germany, for example, has been in a difficult downturn, and they're heavily exposed to exports to China. We also saw other emerging market countries, Latin American countries, roll over along with China. While the U.S. continued to recover and accelerate, a lot of that due to the fiscal stimulus package launched by the Trump administration. But even looking at the U.S. growth, we did feel that it would begin to peak late last year. And part of that was the monetary side of things, looking at the Fed, who was shrinking their balance sheet. They were raising interest rates. They were essentially tapping the brakes on the amount of money flowing into the system. And so that's why we felt that U.S. growth would begin to slow. And this is definitely a kind of a turn of events, looking at the U.S. following the rest of the world, peaking later, and I believe they're also going to bottom later. I think the U.S. will continue to slow for a few more months going into the first part of 2020. And I think when you look at global growth, European and Asian growth, I think you're going to see those begin to inflect higher sooner than the U.S., which is why we're bullish as a firm on international equities and assets, given that they're at a significant discount in valuation relative to the U.S.
So as we discussed last time and in this interview, and as we've been noting as well on Financial Sense with the various blog posts and charts, the overall investment outlook, or let's say the investment takeaway here, is that Financial Sense Wealth Management is moving from neutral to slightly overweight equities, increasing exposure to international and cyclical investments, and that goes back to what we see with the OECD leading economic indicators starting to tick up, and your belief that this will continue. But then also on the bond fixed income side, reducing duration in all the portfolios except for growth, given that you believe we are closer to the end than the beginning of this rate cutting cycle. And then lastly, you also have been noting that we have increased our risk appetite for credit and have obtained exposure in emerging market bonds. Any change to that, Chris?
No. You know, one of the things that we look at is, again, turns in the growth cycle, where peaks in growth, you tend to see peaks in interest rates, you tend to see returns in equities begin to roll over, you begin to see more of a shift towards defensive assets where, for example, in the fixed income market, you tend to see longer-term bonds outperform shorter-term bonds. You begin to see credit in terms of like junk bonds or investment-grade bonds tend to underperform treasuries. And the complete opposite happens when growth bottoms and begins to accelerate. You tend to see riskier areas of the fixed income market outperform, like emerging market debt, looking at credit in terms of the U.S., looking at high yield, which are junk bonds or investment-grade bonds, begin to outperform treasuries. And also with interest rates beginning to rise, you tend to see shorter-term fixed income begin to outperform longer-term bonds.
Okay. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for coming onto our show and giving us an update. Again, I want to remind our listeners that we're going to have a number of charts located on Financial Sense where this interview is. So if you want to take a look at some of these charts, whether or not we're talking about the OECD, LEIs, financial stress composites, or the like, you can definitely do so. And Chris, if any of our listeners want to get a hold of you and discuss your outlook more or inquire about Financial Sense Wealth Management Services, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 1-888-486-3939.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.